vision or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Erin, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 16th, 2026 issue of the New York Times Style Section and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. First article, Island Accessory is a Mainland Hit by Maria Santa Poggi. In 2020, Jackie Wegner started saving money to buy her very own Nantucket Friendship Basket. Last month, Wegner, a 29-year-old lawyer from Chicago, made that dream a reality when she placed an order with Four Winds Craft Guild in Nantucket, in Massachusetts. For one of the baskets, a specialty particular to that island, she paid $2,650 for the 8-inch piece and expects to pay another $1,000 for the custom carved design on top after she receives it in 6 to 8 months. Wegner, who regularly vacations on Nantucket, considers it not just a 30th birthday present to herself, but a sign that I've made it. Lauren Lowe, 40, an interior designer from Atlanta, also placed an order last month with Four Winds for her first friendship basket. In a phone interview, she said it's so interesting to have a piece of history and craftsmanship that you get to wear as fashion. She hopes to get her basket, one that, like Wegner's, will be crafted by the local basket maker Larry Rooster, by Christmas. She declined to share how much she paid. The workmanship, the price tag, the weight. Sound familiar? As tourism soars amid social media obsession with Nantucket, a tiny island of about 15,000 to 80,000 residents, the friendship basket has become a collectible, sometimes compared to an Hermes Birkin bag. New Birkins now retail for $13,500 and up, and buyers must often wait 6 months or more to purchase one. Nantucket Lightship baskets, as they are known when they are open-topped, friendship baskets have a lid, can take 6 to 18 months to make, and have a starting cost of about $2,250 depending on a weaver and size. Vintage pieces tend to go for $4,000 on up. John Sylvia, the owner of Four Winds, said that several years ago he sold a very unusual basket, the provenance of which he said he could not disclose because he had signed a non-disclosure for $35,000. He added that sales of a new friendship basket in his store were up by a little more than 40% this year over last year, and that sales of vintage baskets had increased by more than 30%. Sailors aboard the South Shoal Lightship, who began making baskets in the 1850s as what we would now call a side hustle, said Michael Harrison, chief curator of the Nantucket Historical Association, could not have predicted the Google Trends data would show searches for Nantucket Lightship baskets and Nantucket Friendship baskets skyrocketing in the summer of 2026. Probably neither would Jose Reyes and the Filipino immigrant who in the late 1940s made the basket a purse by adding a lid with custom carvings called scrimshaw. About 5,000 pieces by Reyes, who died in 1980, exist today and sell for about $4,000 to $7,500 on the secondhand market. Even reproductions are gaining value. Companies like Barlow sold a mass-produced version of the friendship basket in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s for about $100 to $200 that have appreciated considerably. Stephen Turner, the fourth-generation owner of Briggs Auction in Garnet Valley, Pennsylvania, recently sold a Barlow basket for $1,700, not including fees. The baskets carry a certain currency on social media as well. Ren Elia, The content creator behind Connecticut Luxury, who has been going to Nantucket for decades, said her videos about the baskets performed particularly well. She received over 350,000 views on a TikTok post last month of women and their purses at the Baskets, Bubbles, and Bourbon fundraiser for the Historical Association. There are purse baskets everywhere, and that's when it starts becoming this badge of belonging, Harrison said. Like, I am a legitimate Nantucket summer woman because I have one of these baskets. So what happens when someone who spends a majority of her summer off-island, as the locals call it, gets one? You know, like a tourist. Connie Ann Harris, a collector and former Vogue executive, is unbothered. She's been acquiring friendship baskets since buying her first in 1997 from Alan Reed, a master weaver on Nantucket. The basket has a legacy, and that's one of the reasons why it's not like any other bag in the world, Harris said. Alexis Hardy Green, 30, a content creator from Pinehurst, North Carolina, who has two friendship baskets, said that in the age of Amazon, the baskets mean more than something that can be easily obtained. In a world where everything is at our fingertips, the baskets aren't as easily accessible. People who are sourcing these bags genuinely care about having something that will last a lifetime and can be passed down for generations, Green added. She is already planning to pass her baskets to her daughter, who was born in April. Nell Diamond, the chief executive and founder of Hill House Home, who grew up spending summers on Nantucket, is unsurprised by the attention online. Whenever I would carry the purses, I would always get the kind of reaction that I'm seeing on social media now, which is, "Oh my gosh, this is so special. Where is it from? Tell me the story," she said. Diamond received her first basket from an auction at 16. It was a real special moment. Diamond, now 37 and a mother of three, said she hoped to pass down her friendship baskets one day. "I got one basket for the birth of each of the three kids," she said. "The true value is the history and authenticity," say the collectors and fans. "There is this move away from things that are heavily branded," said Alaya, the content creator. "People are appreciative of craftsmanship scarcity." Scarcity is certainly a factor in the basket's appreciation. Sylvia currently represents three weavers, the youngest of whom is 75. "There's probably only 6 or 7 full-time basket makers on the island," he said, "and there's only one under age of 50. Next article. Here, Chaplin and Valentino would fit right in, by Alex Vaducal. Norma Desmond would have approved. A sold-out silent film festival took place the other night on the grounds of a forbidding castle on a rocky, uninhabited island in the Hudson River. Crowds munched popcorn as they watched 7 new shorts that pay tribute to the kind of entertainment that was all the rage before talkies arrived. The moviegoers rode a ferry from Beacon, New York, to reach Bannerman Castle on Bannerman Island. They sat under tree canopies in the buggy heat as silent films were projected onto a big screen. But they hadn't gathered to watch the kinds of movies that Desmond, Charlie Chaplin, or Rudolph Valentino would have appeared in. The occasion was the festival put on by Modern Silent Shorts, a roving review and production company devoted to contemporary silent cinema. Since its founding 3 years ago, it has commissioned select filmmakers to make silent films, which are presented at its screenings. While the films pay homage to classic silent cinema, a slapstick comedy, The Weird Guy, directed by Sandy Honig, included Chaplin-esque walks and a swelling Irish shots, their storylines are centered on contemporary life. Clarity is directed by Danielle Jaffe and Michelle Uranowitz, begins with the woman sending out an ominous chain text message. "I'm really scared I'm dying, to be honest," directed by Lindsay Callarian, follows a young man who seeks advice from strangers on an adult webcam site after he suffers a panic attack. The silent medium was wonderful because of the inherent silence of anxiety. Callarian said, "Standing by a crumbling ruin, I was able to create dramatic tension that I just wouldn't have been able to in a normal film." A 4-piece ensemble led by the composer Kevin Donald played beside the screen. Think of the musicians who once accompanied Buster Keaton flicks, and then imagine if they had grown up on Radiohead and the approximates the band sound. Roy Chitlin, A young filmmaker who journeyed to the island from Brooklyn said the evening gave him newfound appreciation for an obsolete medium. Movies like The Odyssey and the new Spider-Man are the biggest films in the world right now. But those films feel almost like rides, he said. There's this thing now where if a movie isn't shaking all of your senses, then it isn't working. That creates an under-reliance of pure storytelling. Seeing these films makes a case for silent cinema. As the storm brewed earlier that evening, the festival's founders and film producers, Lily Weisberg and Michael Bloom, wrote out the rain in a grotto. Both 27, they met as production assistants on the set of a Sofia Coppola movie, and they enjoy watching Lillian Gish films together. Weisberg recounted the festival's origins, which began on the firm of the actress Isabella Rossellini, who is known for hosting screenings on her Long Island property. When a family friend of Weisberg, the financier Boykin Curie, attended one of Rossellini's screenings of old silent films, he was moved by the experience and then approached Weisberg with the idea of starting an initiative devoted to contemporary silent shorts. Through Curie's funding, Modern Silent Shorts grants filmmakers budgets of up to $25,000. Boykin's idea was, what if people were still making silent films today? What would they be making them about? Weisberg, a filmmaker who began directing shorts as an undergraduate at Yale, said, "The way we think about silent films is that we are able to progress out of them. But are there things that can still work better in a silent film?" Bloom had finally come around to the genre. He said after being a little bored by it in his college years, "When I was falling asleep at Wesleyan to silent films in my morning class, I was totally fine with that," Bloom said. "But now I have an extreme affinity for the genre. I've gotten into early Lubitsch movies because I find them so intelligent and economical in their storytelling." As night fell, the moviegoers sat in darkness. Alongside the more intense shorts, the audience was treated to lighter fare, like Brendan McHugh's Head Over Heels, a romance set in Paris, and a stop-motion animation, Flock, by Lucas Ansel, about a lonesome street pamphleteer who befriends pigeons. While the movies played, the chugging of Metro North trains could be heard in the distance. After the final film's credits rolled, people made their way back down rocky trails to the pier. Among them was Sarah McNally, the owner of McNally Jackson Bookstores. "What I found interesting in these movies is the way they made me realize how much silence I'm actually surrounded by, even in loud spaces," she said. "Our lives are punctuated by silence. Even as I walk away now, before I join someone else, there's going to be a moment of silence where everything we just talked about is spinning in my head. It's nice to have movies where that silence becomes the main event." Sean Breen, a musician who lives in Beacon, admired the castle's old ruins as he boarded the ferry. "I think it's very strange, this thing that always happens, where technology makes us move on," Breen said. "Technology always promises to improve our lives, but I only feel more isolated and alone." These older technologies and their truths, like silent movies, I think they kept us a little more human. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next article, she said, "Woke 1.0 was crazy, but what is it?" Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez distances herself from a recent progressive rallying cry by Madison Malone Kircher. "Woke 1.0 is crazy," Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez of New York said in a recent interview. The congresswoman, speaking last Sunday on ABC's This Week, seemed to distance herself from the positions of an era of Democratic politics around 2020, shortly after she rose to prominence. "Some of the left now see the rhetoric of that time as ineffective and divisive. There has been a widespread retreat on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts among corporations. And some public officials, including Mayor Zoran Mamdani of New York, have walked back their calls to defund the police." If woke 1.0 is in the past, when did it die? And has woke 2.0 risen from its ashes? Ocasio-Cortez said on This Week that she was quoting Shai Osei, a far-left New York city councilman, when she described the so-called woke 1.0. That era is sometimes referred to colloquially as peak woke. In May, Yemisi Egbuo, a former Biden White House aide, posted on X praising the Texas State Representative James Tallarico, who is running for a Senate seat after he walked back statements from that era. I think it's great that Tallarico is calling some of his high net woke comments cringe, Egbuo wrote. Honestly, more young people running for office are probably going to have to do this. Peak woke got weird. It's okay to say that. Though the word woke in this context originated in black slang and have been around for decades in grassroots movements. In recent years, it has been used by some Republicans and moderate Democrats as a way to describe policies they view as out of touch. Woke 1.0 retroactively describes the age of the Me Too movement and backlash against sexual assault and discrimination and the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which led to widespread protests against police violence and racial injustice, said Spencer Goidell, a political science professor at Auburn University. This is what activists are prone to do. They overreach, Goidell said, adding the movements had bipartisan support. They say this is our moment. Goidell published a paper in 2025 about ordinary Americans' understandings of wokeness. For many survey respondents in his research, Ocasio-Cortez was a symbol of woke 1.0, he said, as well as groups like Black Lives Matter. Eric Bleich, chair of Department of Political Science of Middlebury College, said some voters were turned off by a shift during the late 2010s to more symbolic politics or debates that appeared to focus on language. Goidell, the Auburn professor, said that President Trump's victory in the 2024 election was an important moment in the move away from woke 1.0. I think that's kind of a wake-up call where Democrats then have to self-reflect and go, oh, we aren't speaking to the common person, he said. I do think there's this active effort within the party now to kind of silence a little bit the academic ease. Blake also pointed to the calls to defund the police as a divisive goal. Years after the large-scale racial justice protests, efforts to cut funding for police or get rid of traditional policing proved unpopular and were largely abandoned. He pointed to President Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s call to fund the police during his 2022 State of the Union address. But many in the Democratic Party emphasized that the era, despite some attention-grabbing policies that never gained widespread approval, led to positive change. The doors were really open in trying to entertain any and every policy that was going to get us to a better place, Ocasio-Cortez said on ABC, describing the discussions of that era as fruitful. In the interview, Ocasio-Cortez was asked why she had not endorsed Francesca Hung, a Wisconsin state assemblywoman and Democratic socialist who lost the Democratic Party for governor last week, despite being ahead in polling. Hung once called for abolishing the police and said the country should cancel Thanksgiving, but has since walked back those statements. I think that's what's important, is what we have to assess what a candidate is saying now, said Ocasio-Cortez, who has also softened her previous stances on the police. For Blake, Ocasio-Cortez's comments are emblematic of a shift in the party saying, hey, okay, we know that we went too far. We know that we progressives essentially wound up demobilizing and neutralizing what could have been and should have been our allies on the left, he said, and made an opening for the right to really use that term publicly against the goals that many people on the left share. As for when woke 1.0 officially died, perhaps it was Ocasio-Cortez's interview that delivered the fatal blow, said Stu Loser, a longtime Democratic communications strategist. In politics, like if we're talking about it on this week, well, you know, then it's dead. Next article, Making You Rethink How to Wear a Shirt by Jacob Gallagher. At 7 p.m. on the first day of Men's Fashion Week in Paris in June, the Japanese label Oralee staged its latest runway show. It was a modest, chummy affair. Supporters clustered in the front row, fanning themselves as models slipped past in wispy plaid shirts and electric blue windbreakers, their sandaled feet clicking along the marble floor. 2 hours later, Louis Vuitton, the alpha dog of the French fashion industry, staged its latest men's show. There were croc skin coats and saggy striped suits presented against the backdrop of a mammoth perpetual wave, like something out of a Dubai mega mall. A gospel choir performed. Victor Wembanyama, Jeremy Allen White, and Missy Elliott were in attendance. Truckloads of sand rimmed the runway. In scale, the shows could not have been further apart. One was a plucky indie, the other a traffic-halting blockbuster. Yet they shared one key character, Charlotte Collette, a blunt 40-year-old from the south of France, who, in the past several years, became one of the most important stylists working today. She has styled runway shows for brands including Jill Sander and post-archive faction campaigns for Tod's and APC magazines. Like the W across these jobs, a Collette sensibility emerges. It is extracted from how people dress on the street, with a bit more polish here, a bit more conscious disheveling there. "I don't like stuff which is too conceptual," Collette said. She is not a stylist who further puffs up luxury fashion, layering on the gems and the jewels. She dresses things down, making outfits that you'd want to print out and tape to your mirror as an inspiration. In her hands, a corporate gray Jill Sander suit is paired with bruised brown work boots. A chandelier sparkly Louis Vuitton sweater vest is balanced by washed out jeans and a pedestrian, almost dorky short sleeve button up. "I like real clothes," Collette said. That realism helps explain why her work has found particular acclaim in men's fashion, where the audience often not just expects but demands a clearer, less fanatical depiction of fashion. "Some stylists use a lot of layers to complicate the clothing," said Fabrice Pinot, the editor of Double Magazine, who has worked with Collette since her early 20s. "She doesn't do that. She's quite direct, and I think that's super fresh." In her own telling, Collette's pragmatism stems from her upbringing. She grew up in a town around 1,000 people so far south in France that its citizens speak Catalan in addition to French. Collette was raised on a farm where her parents made cheese, a line of work her mother continued at until she retired a few years ago. "I really grew up in nature," Collette said. After our first interview, she sent photos from her mother's Instagram account showing verdant hills and herds of sheep, basically the opposite of LV, she wrote. As a child, she did not demonstrate a precocious interest in fashion. "I've never been something like, oh, that little girl. She loves clothes," she said. Her parents wore work clothes. She did too. But she enjoyed drawing, and that led her to go to boarding school as a teenager, 3 hours away by train. Until then, she had spent nearly every night of her life at home. After graduating, she landed at a fashion high school in Paris to study design. When asked about charting the storybook path from the countryside to the capital city, Collette just shrugged. "It was very natural," she said, in Paris. She found friends and compatriots in the fashion world. Still, she was not as smitten by design as she had anticipated. The thought of a career as a knitwear designer at some LVMH label didn't get her going. "That would be the dream of my friends at school," she said. "I was just like, I don't want it." Rather than creating the raw ingredients of fashion, the knits and shirts and suits, Collette was interested in the meals you could make out of them. Magazines with their transportive photo shoots captivated her. She was employed at Purple Magazine and worked for Masha Orlov, an influential French stylist. She inched her way up the stylist hierarchy, working on shoots for Chanel fragrances and Esprit. The role of a stylist in runway show or for a campaign ad can be a tricky one to explain. If a designer is akin to a film director, a stylist is more like an editor. A designer makes a sweater you want to buy. A good stylist composes not just an outfit, but a person you ideally wish to be. Collette insists that it is not a glamorous job. It entails lugging suitcases of clothes and crawling on the floor to pin a pair of trousers on a model. As a result, she never wears anything that would be called luxury. When we spoke, she was dressed almost entirely in Uniqlo. I just like comfort workwear, basic stuff, she said. In her 20s, she struggled to make rent and debated working at the Monoprix retail chain. Eventually, though, she had built up enough contacts and a respectable resume to get steady work styling shoots for various white pages, thick fashion magazines that catered to the most niche and nerdy. At first, she worked primarily in women's fashion because she was there. She found opportunities. I don't really see the difference between men's and women's, she said. On the runway, yes, but in the world, you know, it's the same. Her break came in 2018 when Aura Lee, having made the leap from Fashion Week in Tokyo to Paris, was seeking out a local stylist. A publicist passed along Colette's name and she took the job. She found in the brand a shared DNA with what she likes to work with. I have immense trust in her ability to add an elegant, playful twist while maintaining a deep respect for classic clothing, the Aura Lee designer said of Colette over email. She intuitively catches our current direction and we want to express without needing long explanations. A playful and warm approach to color is the attribute that critics most often hail in Colette's styled Aura Lee shows. In the last show, she styled the suit the color of a martini olive over a dusty dress shirt and a tee with wide blue stripes. In another outfit, she complicated a pair of brown corduroys, the type you would have found at Brooks Brothers in 1973, by coupling it with a zesty aquamarine zip-up. On one side, the shirt collar flipped out over the jacket like an errant splotch of paint on a canvas, making sure the audience didn't miss the shirt's chartreuse color. Yet she balanced the whole look with a pair of brown boat shoes, like something a suburban dad might wear to the country club. Colette knows well where to challenge our expectations and where to validate them. Pinot fittingly described Colette's sensibility as like a collage. Colette had collaborated with reputable French brands before, APC among them, but working with Aura Lee was her first name styling a runway show, a step up into the sphere of attention and scrutiny. She has since styled runway shows and campaigns for the designer Simone Bellotti, first at Bally, then at Jill Sander, the rising Korean techwear label, post-archive faction, and now Louis Vuitton. Colette styles men and women in many of these jobs, but she is conscious that her work, for whatever reason, has landed particularly strongly with men, and it's notable that a majority of designers she works with, including Bellotti, Iwa and Pharrell Williams at Vuitton are men. Next article, singer's skin routine seems just for show. A video of Tate McRae using Neutrogena products inspired parodies over her light touch by Madison Malone Kircher. The ad starts off like many others online that feature celebrities demonstrating beauty products. In this case, the pop star is Tate McRae, and the brand is Neutrogena. McRae, seated on a private jet headed to Chicago for the Lollapalooza Music Festival, demonstrates her post-show routine by using several Neutrogena items to remove her makeup and moisturize her skin. There's just one problem. McRae appears to barely touch her face with the product. In the TikTok video, which has been viewed by at least 18 million times, a makeup wipe grazes her skin, seemingly leaving her face as made up as when she began, and a moisturizing cream is applied with an ultra-light touch. Viewers of the sponsored video were quick to criticize what they described as, "Girl, be careful," a popular comment read, "It's almost touched your skin." Several social media users went on a step further and filmed parody videos pretending to remove makeup in a dramatic fashion. Some of the most popular variations received millions of views. Carly Knowlton, a gym teacher and social media manager in Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania, filmed her own version. While she considers herself a fan of McRae's music, she said she was shocked by the video. "You definitely get the vibe that she does not use those makeup wipes on the regular," she said. Knowlton echoed a sentiment described by many commenters and parody creators who felt that influencers and spokespeople for brands had a duty to be honest with their fans and followers. "If you're going to take a brand deal, be genuine," Knowlton, 25, said. "If you don't like the product, don't take the brand deal." McRae's video is reminiscent of marketing moments past in which efforts to make products seem enticing went awry and created the opposite effect. In 2019, the actor Millie Bobby Brown apologized after posting a video in which she washed her face with products from her own vegan skincare and makeup line and miraculously still had a perfect beat at the end of the clip. In 2018, the actor Shay Mitchell gave a similar performance in the video for Bjor, seemingly holding the products inches from her face while using them. The gaffes aren't limited to spokespeople. Last year, the chief executive of McDonald's made waves when he took the world's tiniest bite of a new burger on the menu. Representatives for Neutrogena and McCrae did not respond to requests for comment. Samantha Molina, a 34-year-old licensed esthetician in Mohama, Illinois, said that she worried about children that use skincare products and the Sephora Kid movement, and that they might feel pressured to purchase skincare products they don't need. Molina thought McCrae's ad posed an ethical issue. If you have that sort of position of power and influence over your audience and society in general, I would feel you should try to address things in a very straightforward way, she said. Like, this is what I do, and this is what I don't do. So at least people know that a product works or doesn't work. Tavia Tran, a drag queen in Minneapolis who also made a parody video, said she was surprised McCrae's video had been posted. Part of the thing that made me laugh is that with ads like that, it's not like Tate McRae just like posts videos for her TikTok, Tran 30 said. It's very likely that it went through a number of PR people or managers. Eva Finn, a marketing professor at Chapman University in Orange, California, said it was the lack of realness in McRae's video and other marketing fails that bothered audiences. Their biggest thing that's so important to them is that these influencers and content creators be authentic, Finn said of young people, particularly members of Gen Z. Dina Maislin, a professor of marketing at the University of South California Marshall School of Business, said the video lacked a core element of what made some influencer content successful. Typically, influencers are seen using the product, Maislin said. Whether it's eating at a restaurant or staying at a hotel, you know they are visibly using it. Whether or not they use it long term is less clear, but at least they're using it for the moment. While Maislin said that McRae's video was embarrassing for her and the product, she added that it probably won't be a continuing problem for the company, citing research showing that even negative publicity can help brands. Now we're talking about Neutrogena wipes with the New York Times, and that's probably not a product we would usually discuss, Maislin said, adding, if anything, it will probably increase the awareness. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next article, Champagne Dreams on Guinness Record Budgets by Guy Trebe. Over the top was the mandate. The client, a wealthy medtech entrepreneur, was on his way to Las Vegas to close a $150 million business deal. A celebration was to be had. He wanted something crazy, Olivia Fernie said. Fernie, 25, is a luxury travel specialist with a knack for fulfilling the implausible desires of her ultra-rich clients. It's hardly a job she could have imagined for herself when she was growing up in Dundas, Ontario. A child of Canadian school teachers, Fernie knew nothing about the world of private jets and $25,000 a day cabanas until she discovered her unusual line of work 3 years ago. I was basically up there in my little log cabin, she said. Nowadays, more than 2 million social media followers watch the videos she posts of her interactions with her tough-to-please clients. She is also making an impression beyond her core audience. Time magazine included her in its list of the top 100 digital influencers of 2026. And Fifth Season, the production company behind Severance and Killing Eve, has signed a deal with Fernie and her business partner and fiancé Troy Arnold for a scripted series based on their agency, Top Tier Travel. On a recent afternoon, Fernie found herself in a chilled room of the Encore Beach Club in Las Vegas, counting out 200 bottles of vintage Dom Perignon. Outside, it was 114 degrees, and the club's three nearby pools were mobbed with tourists wearing patterned swim trunks and neon thongs. Many were chugging $70 mojito big cups. It's a bunch of people getting hammered in a pee-infested pool, is how Fernie described the crowd. The champagne bottles were part of a stunt she had arranged for the medtech entrepreneur, who wanted to celebrate the closing of his business deal in high style. He's a huge Dom drinker, Fernie said. Early in the party planning phase, she had posed a question to the client's spokesman and handler. Would six figures for the champagne alone be a stretch? That would be just another Tuesday for him, the handler said. To that, Fernie replied, let's try to set a world record. Then she got to work arranging a party that would be deemed worthy of an entry in Guinness World Records. It's a sickness of mine that I think I can do anything, she said, to certify the record in the obscure category of largest champagne presentation. Fernie roped in a Guinness World Records educator who would attend the gathering and survey the goings-ons with a close eye. No one is really even going to drink the champagne, Fernie said, noting that her plan called for scores of servers to blast the partygoers with bubbly. After booking special access to the DJ enclosure at the Encore Beach Club, part of the Wynn Las Vegas, she liaised with Diplo, the resident celebrity DJ. She also arranged with Adam Naratsky, the Wynn Resort's vice president of nightlife, to hire nearly every server in the house. On the day of the event, Michael Emprick, the Guinness educator, flew in from New York. For him, the Las Vegas stopover was just one point along a circuit that would take him to Hy-Vee Supermarket in Iowa the next day. I'm going to educate the most pineapples sold in an hour, Emprick said. Don't ask. As night fell, the furnace heat of the desert city was still stuck in the red zone. The gates opened to a crowd of 2,800 revelers who had paid $1,500 to $25,000 for a table at the outdoor club. Few, if any, had met or even heard of the entrepreneur hosting the event. But that hardly mattered. What the glossy strangers provided was an appropriately uproarious backdrop when the inevitable reels of the blowout would stream on social media. Near midnight, with the temperature at 98 degrees, partygoers formed a mosh pit near the stage, pumping their fists to Diplo's bass-heavy set. At exactly 1:30 a.m. came the big reveal. 69 servers, clad in scraps of red jersey, paraded before the crowd, some of them aboard floats shaped like speedboats, fire trucks, and a giant shark. They hoisted bottles of Dom Perignon above their heads. At a signal from Diplo, corks popped. Some servers began hosing down a dancer and a prop martini glass, while others sprayed champagne at the crowd, thus achieving a Guinness-worthy feat that was the equivalent, in terms of pointless excess, to scaling Mount Everest. Undoubtedly, the most elements in this unlikely scene was the client. There he stood away from the action, tucked at the rear of the stage behind Diplo, inconspicuous in black jeans and a black t-shirt. Declining to provide his name for publication, he had earlier explained, though, through a spokesman, that his brief for Fernie was to provide him with something epic. He's been there, done that, seen it all, said Brian Lee, his spokesman. That is to say, he was jaded. Yeah, there is jaded, and then there is a man of means, willing to empty his wallet for the momentary thrill of dousing hundreds of strangers with expensive wine. The final cost for the liquid amount alone amounted to $226,000 in change. Honestly, he would have spent more, Fernie said afterward, but he got hit hard at the casino the night before. One of Fernie's working mottos is, our job is to execute, not judge. Given that she and her business partner are routinely tasked with fulfilling the whims of those who think nothing of laying out $2.25 million for a week-long yacht rental on the Côte d'Azur, this makes kind of cockeyed sense. Each client of top-tier travel must fork over an annual fee of $100,000 and agree to book $1 million a year in travel. John Block, chief operating officer of Park West Gallery, which sells high-priced works of art on cruise ships, said he thinks the fees are worth it. Not long ago, he explained, Top Tier booked a private jet on short notice to collect his ailing sister for a family vacation. You can't just order up a jet like an Uber, Block said. Fernie's videos of her work life have made her social media TikTok accounts addictive viewing. Her interactions with the money few have become digital catnip, an escape from the realities of high gas prices, wars, and the rise of artificial intelligence. And though she may not judge the people who pay her salary, her viewers are free to hate watch. She manages her clients' requests with patience, good cheer, and a dollop of irony. No task is too large or too small. She's flown to Paris to retrieve the largest croissant in that city to please the daughter of a Miami billionaire. For another client, she bought out a day's supply of an Ontario bakery's local famous butter tarts for a holiday meal. backed by a team of 10, Fernie and Arnold, 38, routinely score VIP perks, including reservations at hotspots like the Manhattan Steakhouse, the 86, close access to Formula One races, and bookings on private Bombardier flights for clients so choosy they look at Gulfstream jets. Before starting at top tier, Fernie had never encountered anyone like the client whose child experienced a meltdown when an equipment malfunction forced the family to fly commercial for the first time. "I'm Canadian," she said. Fernie bumbled into this gilded world after meeting Arnold at a Miami club. She took a job with his agency partly to fulfill a visa requirement. By now, she has adapted to a life of unceasing luxury travel. The couple no longer have a fixed address and live mainly on the road in lavish hotel rooms. "Before Fernie came aboard," Arnold said, "top tier lean on one word of mouth and discretion. We worked with billionaires and got our business through quiet," he said. "All that changed after Fernie suggested venturing into social media. We did informational reels that didn't land and then decided to triple down on client calls and reenactments," Arnold said. "People ate it up. Basically, we have normalized what's insane." Over breakfast at the Tableau restaurant in Las Vegas, Fernie acknowledged that a lot of these cliches of wealthy people are true, but there was at least one misconception. "People think the super rich are unhappy," she said. "They are not." Next article, Modern Love. "She thought she was done with passion," by Kimberly Blake. "At 72, I thought I was done with passion. I've closed up shop. I told my friends, and I meant it. I was talking about sex, but what I really meant was my heart. My marriage had been lonely for years. No touching, no reaching, no sense of being wanted. My alcoholism had played a part, but so had my husband's impotence and relentless commitment to work. Just as I began to find my footing, going to meetings, getting help, my husband began to lose his. First, he learned he had Alzheimer's, then he lost his business, his ability to pay bills, to drive a car, even to turn on the television. I nursed him for 5 years. He no longer recognized me by the time he moved to long-term care. I often sought respite at the home we had built together on Cape Cod. That's where I met Charles. At first, it wasn't romance. I simply loved listening to him. His words were steady, thoughtful, slyly funny. It takes a long time for the air to come out of the balloon," he said about his struggle with humility. Sometimes he talked about himself in the third person. "Charles, have you set sail yet, or are you still clearing the decks? I wondered about myself, especially after my husband died. My husband used to say that a room can be dark for 1,000 years, but a single match will light it. For me, Charles was that match. It started quietly enough. One day, he invited me into his old pickup to go to a widow's roadside stand to buy her homemade jam. When we got there, I thought of her as an old woman, though she was probably my age. Around Charles, however, I felt 16. Soon we were meeting for coffee. Then he invited me for coffee at his house and insisted on driving me there. 'That way I get more time with you,' he said, 'because I'll have to bring you back.' I was flattered, also nervous, more than I wanted to admit. At his house, he offered me coffee, grapefruit juice, milk. 'Milk,' I said. He shrugged. 'I like milk.' I wandered around his living room. His shelves were crowded with books about language. I picked up a copy of Mrs. Burns' Dictionary of Unusual, Obscure, and Preposterous Words. 'I have this,' I said. When I found a volume of Mark Strand's poetry, Charles directed me to his favorite poem. When we were leaving, he said, 'Can I ask you a question?' 'Okay. Can I kiss you?' I panicked and bent double laughing, not because this was funny, but because I was terrified. I hadn't kissed anyone in more than 30 years, not even my husband. Charles looked stricken. We didn't kiss. A few days later, I invited him to my house. He told me about his ex-wife, former girlfriends, even a few friends with benefits. I nearly laughed out loud. Charles was 79. He lived in a cluttered cottage and drove a battered truck. He proudly announced that he shopped at the dump. How did he manage to have so many women in his life? For my part, I told him the truth. My marriage had been celibate for 25 years. I might be a little feral. I don't make friends easily. Most women would have presented a more polished version of themselves. I'd handed Charles the owner's manual to all my character defects and watched to see if he would run. He didn't. When I returned home to Connecticut, we talked on the phone every night for hours. Eventually, he said, "Can I visit you?" "Yes," I said. "I'm already packing my toothbrush," he said. "That's a little too intimate," I said. "Fine, I've taken it out and replaced it with the Book of Common Prayer." I laughed. He stayed for 2 nights. They were, I believe, the most erotic 2 nights of my life, not because of what happened between us, yes, we kissed, but because of how he made me feel. Seen, cherished, desired. He wanted me in a way I had wanted to be wanted for years. 2 weeks later, he returned for 3 more nights. We talked into the mornings, one confession to another. One night, he shared that when he got married, his wife was 3 months pregnant, and he'd warned her he would be gone within 6 months. He stayed for a time. "I hadn't had the goods," he said, meaning the emotional capacity to sustain intimacy. I thought, this is not someone who hides who he is. A few days later, I shared with Charles that I had told my children about him. They'd been asking questions because I had effectively disappeared into his new life. He said he had told his children about me, too. He said that he'd been a lone wolf for 40 years and that I was a comfort. Soon we were making plans together. A road trip to Prince Edward Island, a Thanksgiving for two at his place. I was more excited about these plans than I was about my upcoming Camino de Santiago pilgrimage with 2 girlfriends, a walking trip I'd been planning for a year. All I wanted, really, was to be with Charles. On the Camino, I called him every night. I texted photos from tiny Spanish villages. The Camino proved harder than I expected. Some nights before calling Charles, I would have to sit quietly and collect myself. I told Charles I felt oddly emotional all the time, untethered, raw, and close to tears for reasons I couldn't explain. "It's all right," Charles would say softly. "It's okay." On our last day, Charles texted me 5 duck emojis. Cute enough, but not requiring a response, I thought when he texted to ask if I'd receive them, I wrote yes. I stared at the screen, not knowing what else to say. That evening, he asked why I hadn't responded. He said that was me at my most playful, most loving. But then I had received them like a wall of cement. His voice was clipped, his tone cold. I apologized repeatedly. Finally, he said, "Let's just move on," which is what he did. 2 days later, after I returned home, Charles called. "We don't connect," he said. I thought I'd misheard him. "What?" "We don't connect," he said. He said I was an angry person. He commented about my dog. "You don't like my dog?" I asked. "I didn't say that, but you would choose your dog over me." "Well, yes," I said. When he called back, he said there's no point in talking anymore. This has all gone south. Afterward, I texted him our relationship had brought me joy, I said, and I believed it had brought him joy too. I told him I was grieving its loss. He didn't respond. A week later, I asked if we could talk. "I'm not up for an inquisition, Kim," he wrote. That word lodged inside me like a splinter. I didn't want an inquisition either. I wanted to understand what happened. When I finally returned to the Cape for a few weeks later, Charles agreed to meet, but he was cold. "I'm done," he finally said, the unspoken words being with you. He called my text a barrage of words. When I watched him walk away, I felt something inside me vaporize as if he'd erased what happened between us. The fun, the tenderness, and the love. I had no appetite and lost 20 pounds. I talked to psychics, mediums, tarot readers, and a therapist. I cried to my friends. I wanted someone to tell me that Charles was coming back. And somehow I realized that what broke my heart was not simply losing Charles. It was the possibility that I might never be touched like that again, never held, never told I was beautiful. With Charles, the lights had come back on for me, and I felt lit up like a Christmas tree. I felt hope. For months, I thought Charles had taken my hope with him. I thought if I could only understand what had happened, I could finally put the story down, but I couldn't. And I realized it wasn't Charles I couldn't let go of. It was that he had awakened in me. At 72, I thought I had closed up shop, certain that part of my life was over. But I came to understand the shop had never gone completely dark. Somehow a light had stayed on, and it's still shining. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next article, One Star Shines Bright in the Heart of Texas. Austin renames a cinema after Matthew McConaughey, who shows a film and strums a bit. By Sasha Van Olderschausen. Mayor Kirk Watson stood on stage at Barrel O' Fun, a carnival-themed bar inside an Alamo draft house in the city's Mueller neighborhood, as he declared on August 10, 2026, Matthew McConaughey Cinema Day. Be it known that whereas Matthew McConaughey is an accomplished actor and producer, he's also a beloved local Austin icon, Watson read. All right, all right, all right, he added, echoing the actor's familiar refrain. The mayoral pronouncement preceded a screening of The Rivals of Amziah King, McConaughey's latest movie and his first major on-screen role in over 5 years. The film's writer and director, Andrew Patterson, and McConaughey's co-star Angelina Looking Glass were there, along with the indie folk band The Last Bison, who performed, but the night belonged to McConaughey and his Texas-sized legacy in the city that gave rise to the indie darlings Richard Linklater and Robert Rodriguez. Bartenders served margaritas and Negroni-style cocktails made with Pantalones, the tequila brand co-founded by McConaughey and his wife Camila Alves McConaughey. Around 6:15, organizers unveiled a mysterious lump draped in fabric and a stack of cowboy hats to reveal a plaque commemorating the renaming of Alamo Draft House Mueller as the Matthew McConaughey Cinema. A picture of a younger McConaughey, circa Dazed and Confused, with his 70s-style side sweep bob was engraved on it. As the actor's wife and three children lingered nearby, the crowd pulsated around him, tan and glistening in a navy blue suit, his curls neatly slicked back. Their phones rose when he took the stage and spoke in his traveling preacher, free associative kind of way, reminiscing about his unlikely foray into film. A man walks into an Austin bar and meets Don Phillips, the casting director of Linklater's Dazed and Confused. That man went on to become a Hollywood heartthrob before pivoting into more dramatic roles, starting with the director and fellow Austinite Jeff Nichols Mudd and launching his McConaughey-essence, then landing an Oscar for Best Actor for his role as Ron Woodruff in Dallas Buyers Club. Now, McConaughey has entered yet another phase of his career, one in which his persona has grown larger than the man himself, as the face of Lincoln Vehicles, an author, a self-help guru, and finally, a man with a cinema named after him. All the while, he has stayed rooted in Texas, born in Uvalde, where a larger-than-life facsimile cutout looms over the small town. He left for California in the 90s to pursue acting. Years later, he returned, relocating his family from Malibu to Austin in 2014. A University of Texas at Austin alum turned Minister of Culture, he's a fixture at Longhorn's games and teaches a class in the school's film department. On various occasions, he has flirted with the possibility of running for public office, though he has largely kept his political views to himself. The Rivals of Amziah King, which received a standing ovation during its screening at the South by Southwest Film Festival last year, is a blend of genres, part musical, part heist, part revenge fantasy. McConaughey plays the titular character, an apparist with a knack for bringing some people together, often in an eruption of song. Though it was only Patterson's second film, McConaughey said he was struck by its originality and kept sense of its place. The lead character, McConaughey said, is a legend of a man almost mythological in his own mind and in the world that he lives in. When a grisly accident involving a ponytail stuck in an industrial honey extractor reconnects Amziah with his former foster child, Kateri, played by Looking Glass, her first feature role, and one she secured by responding to an Instagram casting call for an indigenous actress, Amziah passes along his knowledge of beekeeping to her. Naturally, this involved interacting with bees, often quite a lot of bees. They were vibrating, said Looking Glass, though she said they didn't concern her much because she's not allergic. Matthew is allergic, she added, but he only got stung once. The Virginia indie folk band The Last Bison, which Patterson is a longtime fan of, inspired the movie's score, which plays an outsized role in the story. The band is featured in several long jam sessions on screen alongside McConaughey, who picks up his own instrument. I didn't know how to play mandolin, said McConaughey, who perhaps is better known for playing the bongos. That wasn't easy. That's just a hell of a lot easier when you ain't got to sing. I find that when I sing well, I don't play the mandolin as well. When I play the mandolin really well, I don't sing as well. We had a rehearsal last night, said Ben Hardesty, The Last Bison's frontman. We had another rehearsal today. For the screening audience members, we were each given a cardboard cutout of McConaughey's face on a stick, which could be held up like a mask or, in a pinch, used as a fan against the oppressive Texas summer heat. Where does Matthew McConaughey end, and where does Messiah King begin? Said Anthony D'Alessandro, a reporter from Deadline. During a question and answer session that followed the film, the actor laughed in response. Then, shortly after, McConaughey was on stage, mandolin in hand. As the boot-pounding folk music played, the sort would ordinarily seem to demand dancing. Many in the audience stood still, instead training their phones on McConaughey, zooming as far as their cameras would allow, taking pictures of McConaughey, recording McConaughey, posting McConaughey. Whether his singing was better than his mandolin playing, it was hard to tell. Really, it didn't matter at all. Article, The Case for Fewer Bridesmaids and Groomsmen, by Shivani Vora. When Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce married on July 3rd, they opted to forego the traditional wedding party of bridesmaids and groomsmen. Their decision reflects a change already underway. More marrying couples are skipping the long-standing custom of large wedding parties made up of friends and family members like Swift and Kelce. They may ask a sibling to stand by them as they wed or choose just a few people closest to them. The wedding planning platform Joy automatically generates a wedding party page when couples create a wedding website, which they can keep visible or hide. They can also add in wedding party members. Taylor and Travis did exactly what we see thousands of couples doing on Joy every month. They chose their siblings, skipped the big lineup, and made the ceremony about the two of them, said Joy's chief executive, Vishal Joshi. Couples are realizing they do not need a cast of 12 to have a meaningful day. Swift choosing a man of honor rather than a maid of honor, Joshi said, is part of the broader trend toward traditional wedding titles. When couples do choose to identify their wedding parties, Joy offers alternatives to conventional titles, such as person of honor or man of honor instead of maid of honor, as well as honor attendant and bride's person instead of bridesmaid. The wedding planning platform Zola also offers alternative titles. There are several reasons couples are rethinking wedding parties. Danny Sow, the editorial director of BG, Bridal Guide magazine, said couples are embracing mixed-gender parties because they allow each person to choose the people they're genuinely closest to. Couples are prioritizing meaningful relationships over outdated wedding conventions, he added. Having a whole busload of people in formal groups seemed silly and performative. It was more interested to have a personalized vibe with the focus on us as a couple. Money is another reason wedding parties aren't as popular as they once were. Sari Cooper, a certified couples and sex therapist and the founder of Center for Love and Sex, a practice in New York, frequently works with couples who are planning their nuptials and said many don't want to put their financial strain on their friends. They want to relieve them from the pressure of paying for their dresses, tuxedos, bachelorette, and bachelor party trips, and other economic realities on top of expenses of attending the wedding itself, she said. Wedding planners and photographers can also speak to the change. Bianca Hall, an owner of Astera Events in Chicago, said that skipping the wedding party has come a much more common conversation during the planning process. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 16th, 2026 issue of the New York Times Style section. We read from the New York Times Style section every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Your reader has been Aaron, and thank you for listening.
Coming up next on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock, we have The Beginning of A World Appears by Michael Pollan with episode number 1. Stay with us for these readings and more. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, broadcasting daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Radio Reading's broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga between William and Clinton Streets. Radio Reading's website is nfradioreading.org. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555.
Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service now presents a reading of articles and features from USA Today